Case number 13-1122 et al. Sorensen Communications, Inc. et al. Petitioners versus Federal Communications Commission et al. Mr. Wright for the petitioners. Mr. Pass for the respondents.
May it please the Court, I'm Christopher Wright, representing Petitioner, which provides captioned telephone service for hard of hearing persons. The key statutory provision at issue in this case was adopted in 1990 as part of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it provides a civil right to functionally equivalent telecommunications services for persons with hearing disabilities. Our argument in this case, all of our challenges, basically are based on the view that the Commission has fundamentally misapplied the statute by failing to read it in context and by giving its terms unreasonably narrow meanings. And I'd like to note that the Department of Justice declined to join the FCC's brief, which is unusual. I'd like to begin with our challenge to the $75 rule, which this court stayed. Under that rule, a hard of hearing person must pay $75 for a captioned telephone, even if that person presents a certification from the world's leading medical expert that that person needs captions. Under the FCC's rule, that person still must pay $75 to prove that they really need the service. This is contrary to the ADA principle that disabled people are not required.
Let's talk about the APA side of it. I mean, you challenged it on APA grounds as well, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
Now, on the APA side of it, the Commission gave a detailed explanation for why it thought the certification was not adequate. And typically, we, as you well know, we defer to expert experience from an agency. What is there about their reasoning that is irrational?
Well, on the APA side, we don't think it's reasonable at all, Your Honor.
They gave a detailed explanation. It's not as if they just sort of blew by this one. They gave a detailed explanation. What is it about their explanation that's irrational?
Well, I suppose the key fact that's missing is that there's absolutely no reason to think that anyone who doesn't have a serious hearing problem has ever received a captioned telephone, certainly not from my client. And the FCC's explanation doesn't counter that. We showed the FCC that nearly 100% of the people who've received phones either have a cochlear implant, the vast majority have two hearing aids, some have only one hearing aid, and everyone has obtained some sort of certification.
What would an adequate certification be like? Maybe if it was a certification that said that, maybe it's different. But that's not what that's not the certification that was before them that they rejected, is it?
Well, we proposed, and the Hearing Loss Association of America made a similar proposal, that what the commission ought to require is proof of a hearing loss. In our case, we suggested proof that you at least have some hearing aids, which, you know,
which
requires a substantial payment and obtain a doctor's certification that you nevertheless need the captioned phones. Ability to pay $75 perhaps could have been a reasonable alternative, but we on the APA side, we just don't think the FCC came close to explaining why they think doctors would be lying about whether a person really needs captioned phones, no evidence that this ever actually happened.
Do you say paying $75 is a reasonable alternative means of policing who needs this?
So the test we propose...
I know you proposed a different test.
Well, no, it included an alternative that you pay $75. We said one alternative that could be an alternative. But we also said that an alternative had to be proof that you have a serious hearing loss and a doctor's certification. And maybe our disagreement boils down to this. In the absence of any proof that anyone who doesn't have serious hearing loss got one of these phones, or proof that doctors are committing fraud, there's simply no reason why that evidence that you have a hearing loss and a doctor certifies that you nevertheless need captions.
I thought your argument was even more fundamental, but maybe I'm not catching. I thought your most fundamental APA argument, talking about APA side of it now, was that the premise for the FCC's action here was there was nothing in the record to establish that. That the reason for the increased demand, the spike in the cost, came from ineligible users. Am I wrong on that? I thought that was the...
No, that is correct.
I don't
correct.
Mean to argue your case for you. I just want to make sure I understand it.
Right. And I suppose the reason I was trying to give to show that there was no reason to think that the spike in demand was due to any sort of misuses, we showed that everybody who's received a captioned phone has a serious hearing loss. The Hearing Loss Association of America added a little flesh to this. Senator Simon in 1990 suggested that 26 million Americans would benefit from this provision. The FCC panicked when the number of people exceeded 150,000 and without any reason to think that people were getting the phones for an improper reason. They just assumed that. The HLAA said, finally, somebody is going out to retirement centers and working with audiologists and explaining how the phone works to seniors, who HLAA also said, so I can repeat it, are not necessarily technologically savvy. And if you tell them, here's a phone that's different from the phone you have and requires a connection to the internet as well as a connection to the telephone line, are going to be reluctant to use it. So the reason that in 2012 the number of people using this service went up was because the caption call, Sorensen created its caption call subsidiary and went out and tried to make the service widely available.
Wasn't the commission's concern here that if there was not some investment required, that just because these phones were free, people might just think it was a cool phone, and they got it for free, so why not?
So, yes, the FCC hypothesized that. FCC has no evidence, again, that anyone who got a phone didn't have serious hearing loss. We are entirely open to the idea that there should be a certification requirement. But let me change my ADA argument then for a moment. It is well established under the other titles of the ADA, which are less generous to disabled people than Title IV, that disabled people don't have to pay for an accommodation. The Eighth and Ninth Circuit struck down very small fees for parking placards, and no court has ever held that a surcharge is permissible in order to get an accommodation, and that's what this fee amounts to. I'd like to point the court especially to paragraphs 12 through 14 of the FCC's order.
Because I want to ask you something about that. Under your no charge theory, could the FCC just say, fine, rather than having a $75 charge, no one gets these, they got to pay for the equipment. Got to pay for their equipment. They already have to pay for their broadband service, right? They have to pay for their internet service. You don't say they have a right to have that for free. So why is the $75 charge for the phone not permissible? Okay.
The test would be, are they paying more than a hearing person, a person without a disability? And so one reason $75.
I don't have to pay for broadband service right. to use my phone.
Right. Well, Your Honor, we're not here challenging
No, but I'm trying to understand what the limits of this charging
right.
theory
right.
that you have is?
Right. Well, we're not trying to make the government pay for anything. Let me make that clear. We're simply, my client wants to distribute phones for free or at most for what Walmart would charge for a regular telephone. And the FCC is prohibiting us from doing that. So we're not.
But isn't it one problem? The cases that you cite all come under Titles 2 and 3 of the ADA, not Title 4. In a Title 4, the government is allowed to, they have to require, have to look at what's functionally equivalent. They have to do things in the most efficient manner. Your ADA argument isn't nearly as strong as your APA argument. And if we agreed with you on your APA argument, isn't that the end of the matter for us? We'd send
yes.
it back and
yes.
leave ADA for another day?
I agree, but let me explain why I think our ADA argument is stronger than you're suggesting. First, the functional equivalent bridge has been crossed. In 2007, the FCC issued an order saying IP captioned telephone service is the most functional equivalent service for hard of hearing people. And there is no second guessing that. And I'm sorry, I don't understand how in the most the language of the other
titles.
Those
are both very ambiguous phrases, and they give lots of room to the agency to maneuver.
I disagree, Your Honor. I think they're two phrases. Sort of to the extent possible is the first phrase.
Right.
And that is a very broad phrase that is more generous to disabled people than anything in Titles 1, 2, or 3, as Professor Bagenstaw showed in his declaration supporting our stay request. So it's implausible to read Title 4 less generously to disabled people. In the most efficient manner, as we've said without any serious argument or acknowledgement of the argument from the FCC, it clearly is a anti-gold plating requirement from the 1990 era of monopoly telephone communications. This statute actually said that all common carriers have to provide functional equivalent service, and the FCC is supposed to ensure that. The FCC has changed the common carrier rules to basically funding the program. But in that era of monopoly telephone providers, in the most efficient manner meant you couldn't go out and spend a whole lot of money just to recover it. It's not clear what it means in this context, but I honestly don't see how there's anything most efficient about a $75 rule or a default off rule. And as we showed in
our... Well, it doesn't need to be the best. You know, it doesn't need to be the best way to... approach. It just needs to be a reasonable way.
I think it has to have some.
Are you still challenging the interim order?
Yes.
Why is that a live issue?
Okay. The default off aspect of the interim order remains live because my client wasn't able to comply with it within the time limit and therefore perform service that wasn't compensated solely because it wasn't in compliance with that order. So that's why it's still alive.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you quickly about your, I was a little curious about your arguments after you talked about default off and $75 about the rest of the rule. And sometimes it sounded like a First Amendment challenge, and sometimes it sounded like an ADA challenge. And I'm just trying to figure out, you're not pressing an actual constitutional challenge to the rest of the rule. Is that correct?
We said that it's also a First Amendment violation, but frankly, I think our ADA argument here.
No, I think you dropped a footnote saying, "Look, as a vagueness, we have to wait for them to interpret it." In your reply brief, footnote two, that seemed to me to.
I'm sorry.
Not normally how one would tee up a First Amendment challenge to these regulations.
What we intended to do in the footnote was simply to try to make clear that should the court not strike down the web of rules kind of barring us from dealing with audiologists, that that we weren't precluded in the future from raising a particular challenge to one of these rules because they're very vague as enacted. Let me say again that sort of our ADA challenge to the whole order, I believe, is very strong. especially if you look at what the FCC did in paragraphs 12 through 14.
Well, the whole order includes the labels on the phones. It says sort of the warning, don't use, you know, here's what it is, and don't use it unless you're really qualified to, eligible to use it, that you sort of wrap your arms around. But that's part of the whole rule that you want to throw out.
If the FCC read Title IV in the context of the ADA and read, to the extent possible and in the most efficient manner in what we think is a proper way, it certainly could have adopted some rules. It wouldn't have adopted, and it probably would have, could have adopted the sticker rule. It would have. We don't oppose the sticker rule. But it would not have, the vast majority of these overlapping rules, which are designed to deter service, the FCC would not have adopted if it was looking as its role to ensure the availability of service to the extent possible. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Greg Pesch. I'm representing the FCC this morning. To address the $75 rule first, that appears to be what the Court's interested in, if I could just frame this with what the Commission was facing when it began to address this problem in the fall of 2012. It saw a sharp spike in the increase in the usage of IPCTS service.
And that justifies bypassing notice and comment? The only cases I could find that allow you to bypass notice and comment are emergency cases, and those tend to be about health and safety. What's the emergency here?
Well, if I could just get to what was before the Commission. The emergency was the impact of this increase on the TRS fund.
Yeah, and you could have raised the tax, right? That was an
option. That's right.
You could have disregarded notice and comment. That's kind of an extreme thing, isn't it? To disregard notice and comment, go straight to a rule?
It's a very unusual thing, and this Court has said in a number of cases, the Mack Truck case, the petitioners rely on, that it is an unusual thing. And this was an unusual situation because the fund doesn't just provide funds for IPCTS. It provides funds for all services. Now, it's true.
Why couldn't you have gone and raised the tax?
That was an option. The commission,
it was.
The
and so
commission
you had the option, raise the tax or bypass due process. There we go.
You also could have borrowed money, right? Doesn't the fund administrator have the authority just to borrow money for
the fund administrator does have the authority to borrow money.
I've seen lots of options other than...
But if you look at what the numbers that were before the commission, Commissioner Pye in a separate statement pointed out that if this growth rate continued through the rest of the year, it would have exceeded the budgeted amount by more than $75 million.
Why would you pursue these other options?
Pardon me?
That's why you would pursue these other options.
Well, it's not clear to me that the fund administrator had available to him $75 million.
Do you know of any other instance in which an agency has bypassed notice and comment for something like this because the program was tough to administer? That didn't involve safety, health?
I do not have another case for you, but the cases...
There aren't any.
The cases
don't... This is extraordinary.
Don't,
absolutely extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. And
I'm saying extraordinary in a bad way. Well, it's remarkable to me. It's remarkable that you bypass due process.
Well, number one, the commission had a genuine emergency before.
No, it didn't. It did not have a genuine emergency the way that we've construed emergency. It wasn't an emergency. You haven't been able to identify any case for me which identifies this situation as an emergency as it's been construed by the courts.
Okay. If I could go on to to describe what the commission was facing. In addition to this increase in usage, this was a unique service for TRS, the IPCTS service, because unlike other services, it was uniquely susceptible to misuse and abuse.
And what was the record evidence that ineligible users were using it and driving the spiking the cost? What's the record evidence of that?
The commission did not point to
record. No record evidence.
The record evidence was, number one.
Extraordinary again. It's two for two.
Okay, this is not going well.
How could it? There's no record. The theory on which the FCC is operating is that this spike in demand is coming from ineligible users. Well, that may be the case, but you don't know that that's the case, and there's nothing in the record to show that's the case.
What the record showed, Judge Griffith, was, as I said, the unique susceptibility to these devices to be misused, the fact that there were clearly marketing practices, the free phones, the referrals for rewards.
Were uniquely susceptible from the beginning. It didn't suddenly become uniquely susceptible in 2012, whatever year this was that you had your spike.
Well, that's true.
Okay. When you had that spike, can you give me a sense of, I assume the commission never thought that all of those new users were wrongful users or unqualified users. Is that correct?
No, certainly.
Do you have any sense of what even percentage they speculated were ineligible users?
No.
Can you even tell us what percentage it was?
No.
So we have to assume there is a large percentage there that are actually perfectly qualified users who just learned about the product or not? What should we assume about that?
Well, the commission did not point to any numbers as to what it thought were misused, but these are prophylactic rules. These rules...
Prophylactic based on what? Based on your sense of what might happen?
Exactly.
And that's enough?
I think it is in these circumstances.
Show me some cases where we've done that, where an agency comes and says, you know, we don't really know what's going on out there, but there's a chance that some bad things may be going on, so let us regulate.
Judge Griffith, I don't think it's fair to say the commission didn't know what was going on out there. The commission did know what was going on out there. It knew what the practices...
Why didn't it create a record of it?
It attempted to create a record. It created what it thought was an adequate record. It didn't think it had... If I could point you to a case in the rural cellular case that's cited in our brief involving the Universal Service Fund, the court noted that in order to protect the integrity of that fund, it was appropriate to adopt prophylactic rules. Now, maybe there was a record that was more satisfying there than here.
No, I have no quarrel with if there's wrongdoing going on out there, if there's evidence that ineligible users are driving the cost up. Well, you know, this service isn't for folks who are not hearing impaired. No problem with that. My question is, my concern is, it doesn't seem as if the FCC created that sort of record. They went on a hunch. At one place, they say, you know, relying on their sense of reason, it seems that, you know, reasonable folks would think this. Well, we need some evidence of that. When you're regulating folks and their livelihoods, there needs to be some evidence on this. The best evidence seems to be that this was a wildly popular service that was doing a lot of good for folks. That's the evidence that they've shown.
I think that's correct. The commission does not dispute that. But the commission believes that for this service to operate in an efficient manner and for the commission to carry out its responsibilities to ensure that the service goes to people with hearing loss and not to people who are not entitled to it, it felt like it was important to adopt rules that limited these practices that the commission believed, based on its experience in this area.
What relationship does possessing $75 have to your legitimate use of this device?
Well, Mr. Wright said that the commission should have simply relied on third-party certification.
No. I'm asking you not to say what you think is wrong with theirs, but to say what on earth reasonable correlation does your willingness to pay $75, or your ability to pay $75, have to your hearing loss?
What the commission said was two things. Number one is that, and this was based on evidence in the record provided by several of the providers of IPCTS, is that the best evidence of someone's need for this service was the willingness to pay for it. And they pointed out their
willingness, but what about ability? I just don't get that. I mean, I really don't get where in this area, let alone anywhere in the Americans with Disabilities Act, we say the best evidence of your disability is in your wallet. Has that ever been said anywhere in the Americans with Disabilities Act?
I can't cite you an instance where that's been said.
And so I guess I know you're repeating what some competitors said, But I'm trying to ask what the FCC's rational explanation is for why the best evidence of disability was in the wallet rather than the ears.
Well, the commission agreed with those statements of other providers. And the commission also, in both the interim rule and the interim order and the final order, looked at alternatives to this in establishing specific scientific standards to measure hearing loss. And if you look at those discussions, there was enormous disagreement among the commenters from groups representing people with hearing loss, from providers, as to whether it was appropriate to have any standards at all. And if there can't be any standards to measure...
Well, that's exactly where commission expertise comes in. When you have communities out there that are disagreeing about what the right scientific standard is, that's exactly where your expertise comes in. What is the right standard to assess disability? And well, given that the rule thought we could use certifications for retroactively for those who already had these phones in their possession, that we can do a certification for. And the FCC acknowledged that states, a number of states, do these certifications. And I'm not sure, again, what the rational reason for the FCC to throw up its hands and say, we can't do a certification, let's forget about hearing ability and look at the wallet.
Well, I'm repeating myself, but the FCC's experience with the disagreement as to appropriate standards.
But why were they okay then for the retroactive? That's what I didn't get, because in the final rule, I know you all tried the certification for the interim rule, and the final rule, you actually adopted a certification requirement for retrospectively, so why did it work there?
Well, for existing users, I think simply because the commission thought it was unfair retroactively to impose a requirement for payment, and perhaps impractical as well.
Mr. Pesch, even if the commission could set some level of payment as a way of deterring fraud, where does the $75 number come from?
Well, the providers who had experience selling these phones as opposed to giving them away, which is what Sorensen was doing, had adopted a number of prices from $99 to $200.
And
I think
none of them adopted $75.
No, I think the lowest price was $99. And the commission thought $75 was a reasonable amount that would that balanced the interest in ensuring that people that it would reflect people's view that they needed this service but would not be an undue burden. In light of the fact that these phones are retail for anywhere from $100 to I think in some cases over $500.
Was there anything wrong with Sorensen giving them away, or is that only wrong to the extent that it's linked to ineligible users receiving them? Is that part of the same argument?
I think that's the case. Yes.
Okay.
This is a very expensive program, and the commission felt it has an obligation as the administrator of this program not simply to throw money at it if it looks like the costs are going up, but to determine mm-hmm. whether this money is going to provide the service that the statute requires the commission to provide. And as we pointed out in the brief, the commission has fairly hard-won experience with misuse of TRS programs. There have been instances with the other TRS programs. The one that was before the court in the case you said on Judge Millett two months ago, the VRS service, one involving IP Relay, where the commission did not get ahead of the problem in those cases, and there was a large amount of fraud and misuse in those cases.
I guess I'm just trying to understand, though, why, when you know, there's certainly plenty of evidence out there, that the number of people eligible for this program is vastly more than the number who are using it. Millions versus thousands. And I understand you have to be good fiduciaries of this fund, but the fund ultimately is just how much is assessed from phone users all around the country, right? And all you have to do is increase that amount, but isn't it not your job to make sure that there is enough in that fund to make sure everybody who is eligible can use this program, no matter how expensive it is? You got to make sure the service is there for eligible people.
That is absolutely true, and I don't. There's no evidence that the commission, despite how its actions here have been characterized as obsessed with money. There's no evidence that the commission would have done anything to cut back this to these practices, or that the commission would have hesitated to increase the amounts that go into the fund if it thought that it was necessary to provide the service. The commission.
So the problem here is you didn't. I think what happened is the commission said, "We don't know." Well, I think you said we know that this increase, some percentage of it, is actually perfectly eligible users.
Yes.
But we think there's some percentage. We have no idea what that percentage is that are ineligible, and so we have to stop the increase in its tracks.
No, I would disagree with your last statement. I think what the commission did was it has to stop the practices that the commission thinks are leading to the possibility of ineligible users, and that are having a limited effect, I must say, on the ability of actual.
But you separately stopped some. I think what you all thought were some of the practices you were concerned about were some of these referral fees and things, and you stopped that.
Correct.
And there, it's directly, there's not a targeted challenge to that.
That's certainly
in this
true.
Case. And you had the warning label. Did you have an obligation to show that you needed this $75 fee or the default option in addition to those other measures?
Well, I think that in adopting rules to carry out its responsibilities on the provision of the Communications Act like this, I don't think the commission, as I think Judge Griffith mentioned, the commission is not obligated to select the best rule or the best set of rules. It has discretion based on its experience and expertise in this area to adopt the rules it thinks are necessary to address the problem that's before it. And it thought the problem of free phones was a serious problem. If you look at the beginning, in both these orders, there are a number of footnotes that cite instances where Sorensen and perhaps some other providers had been giving away free phones and leaving very unclear who was entitled to use these phones. And once these phones get out into the community, once somebody who either is ineligible or who has individuals in their home who are using it or ineligible, and phones get out that default to captions on, and phones are made available for free, the commission.
Each of those users is registered, though, right?
Based on the new rules, yes.
Right. Okay. And even the interim rule, then they have to start the registration in the interim rule as well?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Registration.
So all these new folks are registered and identifiable. In the interim rule, I saw that you, the commission also asked the fund administrator to do a study to determine what the cause of this spike was. Was that study done?
I'm not familiar with it. I'm not aware of that. I do not believe there was a study done, or at least not at this point.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Pash. Mr. Wright, do you actually need any rebuttal time?
If I may make 2 points.
All right, 1 minute.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Judge Griffith, I think you better phrased the prop up here than I had. For each of these sets of rules, the FCC hypothesized misuse and then adopted rules to deter use, and that's wrong under the APA or the ADA. With respect to the studies that have been done, I should have mentioned that the Rehabilitation Engineering Research Center did a study after the interim order and before the final rules. It's a JA-334. This is an independent group that's funded by the Department of Education and the National Institute of Health, and it concluded that misuse did not contribute to the spike. The FCC disputes it in, I believe it's footnote 131 of the order, but I'll just say that footnote is thoroughly unconvincing. Judge Millett, one final point, if I may. You understand this statute correctly. The FCC's duty, the telephone companies have a duty to provide functionally equivalent service to people with hearing disabilities, and the FCC is supposed to ensure that there are funds available to do that. The FCC really does not believe that. It really thinks it can place an arbitrary cap or arbitrary steps to deter use. And that's the fundamental problem here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.